and welcome to a new episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast, this week brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Bell. I am Richard Thomas, Senior Editor Naval, and I'm joined by Air Editor Tim Martin and Senior Land Reporter Tim Fish. Hi, both.
Yeah, good evening.
Hi, Reg.
Coming up in the show this week, we are in conversation with Arelis regarding its research and design contract with the UK RAF. I speak with Viasat to explore developments in cyber defence capabilities and evolutions in the digital battle space, and our sponsor Bell provides this week's Industry Voice segment. And on a personal note, after more than 18 months heading up the podcast, this will be my final episode. A big thanks to you, our listeners, for being part of the journey, and to my colleagues, past and present, for their insight, views, and patience over the years. All of that to look forward to then, but first, let's look at some of the headlines in defence this week. And the United States Air Force has suffered a setback in its quest to develop hypersonic weapons after experiencing a failed booster vehicle flight test for the prototype AGM-183A air-launched rapid response weapon, also known as Arrow. The booster vehicle for the conventional hypersonic glide weapon prototype failed to launch from a BH-52 Stratofortress on the 5th of April in a flight from Edwards Air Force Base to the Point Mugu Sea Range. It would have been the 8th flight test for air-launched rapid response weapon following 7 captive carriage missions. No details are available as to when the flight test will be rescheduled. Russian company Rostec announced on the 9th of April that the Lyulky Design Bureau at its United Engine Corporation, UEC, subsidiary, has completed initial tests of a pulse detonation engine demonstrator. UEC eyes potential future applications for this type of engine in supersonic and hypersonic aircraft. Pulse detonation engines use supersonic detonation waves as a combustion mechanism. One major advantage of this method, as noted by NASA, is that pulse detonation does not require an expensive turbo pump to boost fuel and oxidizer to extremely high pressure. The 9th NATO-owned Airbus A330 multi-role tanker transport, MRTT, aircraft will feature the J-Music missile protection system from Elbit Systems, the Israeli company announced on the 13th of April. Elbit will supplement J-Music on the latest A33 MRTT with its passive airborne warning system, infrared missile detection and warning capability. The 9th MRTT aircraft was ordered in September 2020. Elbit was awarded the original contract in December 2017 to provide J-Music to the NATO MRTT fleet. And in naval news from the UK, Babcock International and BAE Systems will continue in-service support for the 4.5-inch Mark 8 media-caliber guns used by the Royal Navy on its Type 23 frigates and Type 45 destroyers. Under a new 5-year contract extension from the MOD, worth about £43 million, the two companies will support the semi-automatic guns on 19 vessels, plus the shore establishment HMS Collingwood. The current 5-year support deal, worth £41 million, expires this year. It's also worth noting that Babcock on the 13th of April announced to the London Stock Exchange that 1,000 jobs will be lost from its worldwide operations over the next 12 months amid a restructure, with around 850 thought to be from the UK. All right, headlines done. That's enough from me. Time to bring in the rest of the team. Gang, I wanted to get your take, actually, before we go into the actual domains, on President Biden's announcement of the departure of US forces, of the remaining US forces from Afghanistan on the 11th of September this year. So there's around 2,500 US troops left in the country and around 7,000 from other NATO partners. He's unlikely, I think, to jet onto an aircraft carrier under a mission accomplished banner, but how do you think his team's going to spin it, if at all? Tim Fish, Landside.
This has been a long time coming. They'll probably spin it like as if things will be okay, but and that the training of the Afghan army is up to a good enough standard that they can maintain law and order. But that's already not the case. I was there in 2014 watching British forces draw down and went over to see to Camp Shorabak to see the training of the Afghan army there. And while it was all, you know, this is all going according to plan kind of message that was coming from the MOD, when the force was drawn down from Helmand, within not a significant amount of time, all the places that we'd heard about, all the outer bases and places throughout the province were back in Taliban hands again. And it just felt like the whole journey since 2001, 2002 had been a bit of a waste of time. So they'll spin it whichever they want, as if this is a, you know, not a defeat, but it's going to go back to the way it was before, where you'd have a government in Kabul, which basically has enough military forces to control Kabul itself. And then the outer regions will just fall one by one like dominoes, it seems, without a sustained significant support from the US in long term. That's the way it's going to go. I don't see any other any other answer to that, really. The US and the West are not going to commit for, you know, the next 50 years or whatever. So it's going back to Afghanistan the way it was before and the way it has been.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's 20 years of blood, sweat and tears to effectively return the country to a position that it might have been in, say, 1990 or 1995. It's how's it affected the land side of things? Because, of course, that, well, the Afghan war and, of course, in Iraq, this whole concept of, or this sort of doctrine of IEDs really changed the way armies had to fight and equip themselves, didn't it?
Yeah, it was really, if you look at it long term, it was a massive distraction. The end of the Cold War, and then the move into the kind of war on terror. There were plans for sort of development of armored vehicles and armored vehicle programs, and not just in the US, but in the West in general. And they all got sidetracked by operations in Afghanistan and developing MRAPs mainly. I mean, the British Army in particular had to kind of re-roll its entire force to kind of engage in that conflict, and everything else became secondary, and which is why, I mean, the US Army is the same, and why they're all playing catch up now to kind of do this facing a near peer threat from Russia and China. And a lot of money was spent on developing MRAPs and developing the force structures needed to do kind of a counterinsurgency occupation, if you want, a colonial occupation kind of a force, which is what it was. So now all that's done, and all these MRAPs in the US are kind of sitting around being sold off at, you know, knockdown prices are being given to National Guard units and everything like that. So again, it did have a massive effect on land forces. I mean, the Western land forces are now very good at counter IED and counter terror kind of operations. Mm. If anything, any of those come up again, and they want to, you know, do a long term counterinsurgency campaign in another country in the near future, they'll have the material to do it, but that's not really what land forces are now shaping themselves to do anymore. So a lot of these MRAPs are now being used for sort of kind of APC kind of roles for non-frontline combat operations.
Yeah, gotcha. Tim Martin, over on the air side, I mean, similar question, really, that the Afghan war, I mean, the air domain has enjoyed, well, 20 years of complete superiority over Afghanistan, and it's been able to practice land strikes completely free. It's been a remarkable period for the air domain, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I would echo what Tim was saying, just in terms of how you might expect the US to spin this. I'd probably also add that Iran, countering Iran, is obviously the big priority, and you hear from US DOD sources in terms of the doctrinal position that's very clear, and so that has a higher priority, as Tim had mentioned, kind of the war on terror and leaving than all of the coalition efforts behind, so to speak. But I think from the air side, you're absolutely right to flag up that air superiority was part, kind of one of the biggest trends to come from the counterinsurgency stuff. And as I say, if you talk to anyone, certainly in the RAF or the MOD at a kind of senior leadership level, that the pivot at the moment, or the concern, is that won't be the case in any future wars. And so, you know, these sixth generation fighter concepts and remote carriers and efforts to make sure that systems are networked and are more capable, you know, that all of that feeds into those types of kind of worst case scenarios that are being thought about. But certainly, yeah, in terms of, if you look back over the 20 year period, I would say you could point to kind of lessons learned and things like that to say that strike operations and things like that were fairly straightforward. And going forward, there's absolutely a doctrinal position that absolutely isn't going to be the case in 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, indeed. So lessons learned across the land and air domains in sort of an operational context and a technological context, but really one obviously fears for the future of the country moving forward. Okay, Tim Fish, let's go over to your land domain. What's been the pick of the bunch this week for you?
The main news on the land side this week has been the US Army's decision to downselect two contenders for its cold weather all-terrain vehicle program. This is BAE Systems Beowulf vehicle, which will compete against an Oshkosh Defence and ST Engineering Bronco 3. For the uninitiated, an ATV is not like a quad bike, which some of them are known to be. It's more like it's a sort of a box on a tracked chassis, and then which tows another kind of utility truck behind it. They've been used in the past for kind of Arctic operations, and also they've been used in Afghanistan as well, actually. And they've been pretty useful, and they've been kind of an enduring feature of some of the more modern militaries. The efforts to procure these is a part of the US Army's drive to improve its Arctic capabilities under its recent Regaining Arctic Dominance strategy paper that was released last month. The US Army wants prototype vehicles to be delivered by 14th of June, so it's not too long away. And then they're going to undergo testing in later this year in August to through to December. And the US Army is going to make a final down select in the third quarter of next year. They're looking to get about between 110 and 163 vehicles, which doesn't seem a lot, but when they're going to be deployed probably only in the Arctic with the forces up there, there's a fair amount of vehicles. I mean, the Arctic strategy does really want to modernize its Arctic forces up there. They feel like they've lost dominance, and they want to regain this status. As Russia's improving its forces, China is also making a claim to the Arctic as a near Arctic country that it says it is, and it's increased its own dominance there. But this means that the US is facing both Russia potentially and China at the same time in this particular region, which isn't the case if you look at sort of Europe and the Asia Pacific, where they have to deal with these countries separately. So that's kind of a different dynamic to the issue. I mean, a lot of the operations in the Arctic are going to be air and naval based, but the army does want to create a multi-domain task force up there. A lot of that's to do with improving communications and networking and everything. But the plan is to replace its small unit support vehicles, which are really old versions of the kind of an ATV, which is based on an old BV-206 from BAE Hägglunds. So they're going to do that and in a quite rapid pace. And then the Arctic strategy does also say it's going to investigate what it says is further changes to motorized transportation to provide forces and mobility. So there could be further procurement activities down the track. The only other major armored vehicles they've got in theater are a Stryker Combat Brigade, which is an 8x8 vehicle. But then they're not as specialized for Arctic and cold weather operations as the CATV will be.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's interesting that you're talking about a US military that's recognized it's got shortfalls in the Arctic capabilities, and clearly it's trying to do something about it. A little bit late, perhaps, but better late than never. Okay, thanks, Tim. And to Tim Martin and the air side, we've got more procurement troubles, let's put it that way, in Poland, I hear.
Yeah, we have a story from freelancer Gregos Sobczak, based in Warsaw, and he's mentioning that the Perkos, the Polish Perkos light helicopter program, has been part suspended, and that's really down to technical dialogue on the program has stopped for the time being, and as he puts it in the story, it's to resume at an undisclosed future date, and really the idea is that the Polish Armed Forces want to collect more up-to-date information from industry. So I think that's kind of dovetails well with what was the story that I'd reported a couple of weeks ago on the Kruk program and plans being redrafted at the moment. There's no concrete plans in terms of the amount of costs involved for Kruk when there's no dates in mind or set timeline-wise. And there's nothing concrete in the number of helicopters. So getting back to the Perkos program, which is an effort to replace Poland's Mi-2 helicopters, with, you know, these are multi-role rotorcraft. So yeah, there's clearly on kind of the rotary side for Poland, there's big issues at play. So it's a bit of a double whammy when you take in both of these efforts.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just said that they're looking to get more. Poland is looking to get additional information. I mean, surely it's not going to be about platforms it could potentially acquire, because all the information's out there. I'm sure primes and companies involved in Rotorcraft would be more than happy to supply the information that Poland needs quite quickly. So, what information do you think Poland's after? Looking at its balance books again, probably, right?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, the only other kind of thing that comes to my mind is that at a kind of procurement level, the resources that Poland have within the MOD may not be up to scratch, or, you know, that the personnel required to do the job aren't able to take on board the information and process it as quickly as possible. Again, I've absolutely no indication that that is the case. I'm simply suggesting that, as you rightly point out, that the idea that they're assessing the most up-to-date information, and that means that they're going to have to stop the process, it feels very unusual, and you'd have to kind of think, well, you know, is there some kind of something strange happening behind the scenes? Or, as you say, is this all to do with budgeting, and in 4 or 5 months are we going to be hearing about a potential reduction in the amount of money being put forward for this, or is going to be a rethink between Perkos and Kruk in terms of which comes first? Because there does seem to be an issue in terms of making sure that both of those efforts remain a priority and happen in quick succession. I'm not convinced that they will, to be perfectly honest.
Time will reveal all things, I think, Tim. Thanks both. Good stuff. All right, for our listeners, if you'd like to find out more about Shepherd's daily defence news coverage, previous episodes of the podcast, video content and more, please visit our website, shepherdmedia.com/news. Coming up after the break, Tim Martin speaks with Aurelis on its R&D contract with the RAF and teaming up with Thales to develop its eponymous family of aircraft. Stay with us.
This episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast is brought to you in partnership with Bell. To learn more about the latest developments of the Bell V-280 Valor and the generational advances it is bringing to the US Army, you can visit bellflight.com. In short, the V-280 Valor will provide the transformational capability to modernize Army aviation. This revolutionary weapon system is the only long-range assault aircraft to have demonstrated the ability to go twice as far and twice as fast as the current fleet. The V-280 cruises at speeds greater than 280 knots, cutting mission transit time in half while eliminating refuel stops, turning a 9-hour mission into a 3-hour one. This truly is an astonishing achievement from Bell, one that's been more than 7 years in the making. You can learn all about it on bellflight.com. Stay tuned for more on the V-280 Valor later in today's episode.
I'm Shepherd's reporter, Tim Martin, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Tristan Crawford, CEO of Aurelis, the UK-based modular aircraft manufacturer, to discuss, among other things, a new 3-year R&D contract with the RAF. Tristan, welcome to the podcast, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim. Delighted to be here.
I just wanted to start with the heritage of Aurelis and those that might be less familiar with the company. Can you outline how things got started and the significance of offering and developing modular aircraft?
Sure. I think my background explains a lot to the history of Aurelis. So I was originally with Airbus, where we were developing families of different aircraft for the commercial aircraft market, covering many different markets, but with a lot of commonality between the members of the aircraft family to make operating them very simple and cost effective for the airlines. So when I moved into defense aerospace, it was quite frustrating to see that our military kind of had nothing of the kind, really. They obviously with low budgets, bolting fleets of incompatible aircraft together to get stuff done, particularly for flying training. It was quite an eye-opener. So, I mean, that in conjunction with seeing that the UK's got fantastic aerospace capability in every respect, from structures to systems to transparency to landing gear to propulsion to flight control, and also the need to really excite our younger generation about the future of UK aerospace, I really decided it was time to kind of launch a a new idea into the defense market that could solve this problem for the military using a little bit the same kind of approach that the commercial market was using. And with that, generate lots of cost efficiency for the military market, just as the airlines enjoy in the civil market. And also at the same time, you know, it's sobering to think that on the UN Security Council that we're the only country that doesn't have our own ability to develop our own sovereign military aircraft, although that's obviously starting to change now with FCAS. So I felt it was really important that we did something about it as a country. So with that in mind, I really thought about, how do you solve this problem? And for this kind of aircraft at the small light jet end of the military jet spectrum, I could really see that you could design a common core fuselage that would stay the same, but that you could bolt onto different wing and engine types to really cover the wide range of missions that a customer might need. And we started looking at that in the training space, and then realized that with a slightly more powerful engine and with higher performance wings, we could do more than just training. And really what you get for that is, for the price of developing, you know, one aircraft, if you like, it's a little bit more than that, but for the sake of simplicity, designing one aircraft system, you can get three or four types out of it as a minimum. And at the same time, rationalize all the maintenance and training and support that goes with that because of the commonality of the core of the aircraft. And that's a model that works really well in commercial aerospace. It's already being used in land programs like Boxer. It's used in the maritime market as well with global combat frigates and naval ships, et cetera. So it's nothing particularly new. It just hasn't been really brought into the defense aviation market. And then when you've got this kind of common system, when you think about the commonality of the cockpits, for example, and the systems on the aircraft throughout the fleet, training students and instructors to fly these aircraft becomes much, much simpler because they're not having to change from one system designed by one company to another system designed by another company, and the military having to fund all those conversion costs. And then when you add in all the savings from the commonality of the spares and support, which showed to us, you know, time and time again, that you save at least 30% on true life costs compared to anything else that's out there. And you spread all the development costs across all these different applications. You bring the development cost per unit down significantly. You can knock off up to 40% of the price compared with other aircraft as well. So it's an incredibly powerful concept. And then, you know, lastly, when you've got this modular approach that can do so many different things around a common core, with that common core being wired up digitally using a common avionics and information system, you think about all the data that you can draw from across the whole fleet about how those airplanes are being used, how the pilots are operating them, when to predict spares are going to be required because you've got so much big data around how the aircraft is actually working, that you really can change the whole paradigm about how an Air Force operates a fleet of jet aircraft. So for that reason, obviously, we're really excited about the concept and the potential that the company has for this market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you touched on, the thinking behind development from a design perspective, it's kind of in vogue in the commercial sector and less so in defense.
Yeah.
Do you consider Arelis to be sort of a trailblazer in that sense, or, you know, why has this not happened before, or what has it taken for you to make the leap specifically?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a very obvious question. I think the honest answer is that the defense aerospace industry has really got used to operating in a model where, because of the enormous funding you need to develop military airplanes, that there is the model that you wait for the government to fund to take the risk and to pay you to do it, which is fine, and we get some very fine aircraft out of it. But it does mean that the aircraft you get at the end of it are very, very niche. They're designed for a very specific set of requirements for the government who needs that airplane. And then when you try and sell that solution into wider markets, you struggle because they are so expensive and they're so niche that financially and commercially it's a challenge. And we think from Arelis, the future is about being much more commercial and flexible than that. So really what we did was to say, well, look, we believe so much in the power of this concept. We're going to take the risk on ourselves to fund this and find private money to do this and develop an aircraft system which private companies in the future, commercial service providers, can buy in bulk, just like they do in the airline world. So leasing companies buying fleets of airliners. And these companies can reconfigure the aircraft as they wish and deliver them as a really flexible service into air forces that are much more agile and deliver what the customer needs when they need it and deliver as much of it as they want or as little of it as they want. And we call that concept defense aviation as a service. And we think that's really the future. So when you've got that kind of commercial potential around this kind of way of developing an aircraft, it's much easier to raise private money to do it. And that makes a much more commercial investment sensible. And so you can develop this privately. And in that way, we're starting a new model for this sector that really hasn't been possible before because of the way of seeing aircraft design as being so niche and fixed.
Okay, and if we just wanted to touch on the scale of the company at the moment, at what scale are you working? And, you know, in terms of if there was production contracts up for grabs and things like that, you know, at what point could you, you know, think about those types of ideas?
So we're at the obviously the early points of our 3-year contract with the RCO to put in place really all the digital enterprise to be able to have the horsepower to develop this very fast. We've got a 3-year timeline to get the first vehicle into the market. And then after that, we have a 2-year certification phase to get into initial operating capability around the middle of this decade. But obviously, what we want to do at the moment is really about plugging together existing aerospace capability in the UK, because we have no interest in trying to recreate or create a new aircraft company from scratch. We're all about taking existing expertise and putting together a digital backbone that connects the organizations and expertise together with all the great skill sets and capabilities that we've got. And effectively push the button on a conventional aircraft design that is fully modular, that's very easy to develop using off-the-shelf technology, so that we can really get into the market quickly. And there is, from the get-go, a very large market potential in training. So a lot of the world's air forces are about to recapitalize their trainer aircraft fleets, which they bought in the 1970s and 1980s, and which are now getting extremely old. And if you haven't got training aeroplanes, you can't have pilots to fly your front-end jets. So we see that market as being very significant. It's of the order of $150 billion plus worldwide over the next 20-25 years. When you look into also how that type of aircraft will be extended into some of the light combat and ancillary combat roles that we also see these aircraft being able to fulfill. So from now on, we are already putting in place the organisational enterprise across the UK that's going to be able to deliver this very, very fast. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and just on the R&D contract for the RAF and the RCO, as you mentioned, can you tell us just a little bit the background? I mean, how do you go about gaining a contract as significant as that? And, you know, it's a 3-year investment, you know, and it's highly significant.
I would say, first of all, it's about the fact that we are very committed to the program being developed at the heart of the UK and the Royal Air Force. And the RCO is the ideal place to start. Our values of the company are very core to the values of the UK and the Royal Air Force. And we made that clear from the start. And it was all about a lot of good relationship building over time. It wasn't quick, but it certainly was worth it. And it's about making sure that you understand or how to communicate your vision into the strategy of the Royal Air Force and the RCO at the right time. So the timing in the for us has been good in the sense that projects like the Future Combat Air System and Tempest is starting to think about more than just a one aircraft solution, which at the high end is a very highly capable combat aircraft, but thinking more about the smaller, more agile, scalable aircraft systems that will come around that to deliver the future combat air system we need in the future. And because the customer is thinking in those terms about the agility of the platforms they need at the smaller scale, that still need to be really cost effective. What we're proposing as well has fallen in at the right time in that thinking process that has made sense for this contract to happen.
Okay. And because you also mentioned Tempest there, have you been invited to discuss that by the RCO? Would there be any potential links between Aurelis and the wider program generally, or what could you say on that front?
Certainly our ambition is that we are positioning ourselves to be seen as a training system solution for Tempest in the future, for the future combat air system. And that's a discussion we're now having, and we're making sure we're in the right position, the right time to be ready to ensure that the UK and the Royal Air Force also has a next generation training aircraft system that's ready for Tempest at the right time when they're ready to pick that up and go with it. Mm.
So presumably that's the discussion around a successor to the Hawk.
Yeah, it's a great question. Aurelis is capable of replacing the Hawk. Obviously, we're in that category of aircraft. It's about planning for the future. So we're looking beyond Hawk and what's going to happen in the future of flying training in the UK in the long term, particularly with supporting Tempest. And it's that process takes a long time. You need to spend a bit of time figuring out the requirement, how you're going to bring technology together and make sure it's pitched at the right level at the right time to be ready for things like FCAS and Tempest. And so it's about creating options for the Royal Air Force and the MOD about how they can move from the current model into a future training model in the future when they're ready to do that.
Okay. And on that front, I mean, there's been some discussion around, you know, new technologies like augmented reality cockpits for Tempest perhaps coming down the line and things like that. Would that fit into, you know, the company's position on modular aircraft and things like that, or kind of are those two separate to consider?
No, absolutely. I mean, we're starting with the kernel of the whole opportunity, which is having an aircraft system which is truly flexible. And it's about as Air Marshal Rich Knighton quoted in our press article and in our press that it's about breaking the cost curve that has really held back this sector for so long in terms of its cost effectiveness. But then when you extend that into the potential solutions for training that we're going to need for Tempest and the future combat air system, it's about developing all the training system that's going to be needed around that flexible aircraft concept that's covering everything from the design of the syllabus through to the simulation systems that we use, through to the way we manage learning around how you fly a flexible aircraft system. This is all the ecosystem, if you like, that will grow up around our aircraft design as it progresses. And we're currently in discussions with a number of companies about how that's going to shape up and what that is going to look like.
Okay. Do you want to give us anything further on those discussions?
Yeah, the one I will mention is I'm very delighted to announce that we have a contract with Thales UK, and it's a teaming agreement to work together initially on the simulation solutions that come with a future training aircraft system. So we're delighted to be working with the Thales team on that to build in some of the forward-looking thinking they have in this space around how simulation, for example, is going to change in the future, and how that integrates with future learning management systems to improve the rate at which you can train pilots and make sure they're ready for a new way of operating combat aircraft in the future.
Mm-hmm. That's very exciting. I want to just come back to the RAF and the 3-year development contract. And, you know, you can call me a hard-nosed journalist for the following, but I mean, I think there is, in some quarters at least, a perception that owing to budget, the RAF often commit to R&D and technology maturations efforts without them moving to issue in production contracts, you know, once the experimentation finishes. Is that something Aurelis would like to see change? Is there reason for optimism beyond the three-year partnership?
As I mentioned before, in terms of the kind of conventional model that defence aerospace works on, I mean, the reality today is that defence budgets are just not sized anymore to protect industry from the risk of developing these kinds of aircraft. And so you've had this kind of stalemate for a long time the public purse really cannot fund these kind of programs until it becomes really critical. And obviously now it's great to see that the combat air strategy is now happening and we are starting to do that again. But I think the reality for us is, as I kind of referred to earlier, is that we see a new way of doing this, which is that if you can see the whole issue as a commercial proposition that's going to create new business models for service provision of defense aviation as a service in the future, where private companies can actually deliver the capability for an air force really cost effectively using a flexible aircraft system that can be leased into an air force, for example, and flex depending on exactly what the customer wants, so they can buy as little of or as much of as they want from one year to the next, and they can change that on an ongoing basis. And we can re-roll the aircraft into those markets, re-roll them out into other markets, and operate that commercially. Then there's every reason that you can actually raise private money against that and develop a commercial company that can develop the vehicle that allows that business model to happen. And then you're no longer dependent on the public purse and the MOD, for example, budgets to get your aircraft program into the air. And at the same time, you're creating an investment opportunity for private investors that is a good, healthy commercial company.
And just wanted to finish then, because you did mention about the high value of the training market and potential for future contracts. How do you best go about, having those contracts signed? Do you have to work in partnership with the UK government, or can you do it off your own bat? Or just talk us a little bit through those processes and things like that.
I think there's the space to watch is with our business model being targeted very much at enabling commercial service providers to buy fleets of these aircraft and lease them flexibly into many different markets and giving them much more breadth of market to address. That's the space that the valuable contracts are going to be in. So if you're a provider or supplier of a solution that can help enable that model, I think that's the place you need to be. So companies and organizations which have the ability to enable good risk management on service provision, good just-in-time delivery of components and spares, good digital tracking of parts and spares to make a whole system work effectively, companies which are good on the management of data, big data across big networks of vehicles that interface with a ground-based system and can knit those systems together. Those are the places where the value is going to lie.
Okay. Tristan, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And as company developments move forward, hopefully we'll pick up the conversation again at some point soon. Thanks again.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Tim.
Hello, my name is Andrew, and Shepherd has asked me to speak to you about my experience with Defence Insight, Shepherd's all-in-one market analysis tool that has helped me spend less time finding opportunities and more time winning them. With full market data at my fingertips, I'm able to identify upcoming and lapsed programs, see the bids that won and failed, and, this is the part that really helps, beat my competition to opportunities and increase my win rate. Shepherd's tool brings together programs, systems, and subsystems into one integrated location, so you can see the entire supply chain. So whether you're a researcher, business developer like me, or your role is focused on strategy development, see how powerful Insight can help improve your everyday with a free product demo. Contact the experts at insights@shepherdmedia.com.
In the digital depths of a cyber domain, vast networks of state, non-state, or state-supported actors are seeking to remap the world order. Information and disruption is the currency, which has a value many times more amplified in the physical world. Unlike real wars of kinetic action, these cyber attacks often go unreported, or worse still, unrecognized, and are perhaps one of the most definitive influences of the modern battle space. The question is, how can this be countered? What measures do societies have to enact in order to protect their digital borders? Well, to answer this question, I'm joined by Ken Peterman, President of Government Systems at Viasat. Mr. Peterman, thanks for coming on the show.
Hello, Richard. Glad to be here.
So, as a bit of background to the whole conversation, it's worth mentioning that cyber attacks are relatively commonplace. Indeed, the US Treasury, the DOD, the intelligence agencies have all been attacked in recent months. The US Center for Strategic and International Studies recorded more than 20 significant attacks worldwide by state or potentially state-supported actors in the first 2 months of this year alone. So could you outline to us, to give a broad understanding for our listeners, what threats are posed to the US and its allies by cyber attack?
Well, cyber attack has a variety of different vectors, and sometimes it is to disrupt processing, disrupt economics, cause companies and populations to lose faith in their systems, and otherwise be concerned about their loss of privacy, loss of financial data, loss of personal data, or more severely, that the loss of that data, that personal data, and those kinds of things can actually result in financial damage or loss of classified documents or those kinds of things. And this type of intellectual property, when lost, it represents billions of dollars and years or decades of investment in terms of technology leadership and those kinds of things. So the loss is quite severe, and it allows a potential adversary to move in leaps versus having to make the investment themselves and trying to overtake or catch up with the technology trajectories that Western nations, and particularly the United States and the UK and company and organizations like that are on. So it's a very devastating threat because of the amount of ground gained or the amount of technology that can be gathered really in nearly an instant. Okay, and so it's a very devastating kind of threat, and it's a threat that exists in this gray zone of conflict or Cold War. This is why sometimes we call the cyber a fighting domain, because it is a domain where attacks are commonplace. It's a domain where there is, it's not like a kinetic strike or something where there is clear attribution of where it was sourced or who caused it. So in many ways, it becomes a kind of an area of gray zone conflict where adversaries can do more than just raise havoc. They can actually cause financial or other harm, and they can make leaps in terms of their technology advancement in very short amounts of time and with almost no investment.
Which seems like a significant threat, indeed is a significant threat to nations looking to maintain their qualitative edge. How does a government then set up itself to defend itself against cyber attacks? Where is this sort of the technology and the expertise obtained to create this structure to defend and, if needs be, attack back?
Well, I think it's an area, I've been in this business now more than 40 years, and I remember being a part of the defense industrial base that was inventing satellite communications and mobile networking and cybersecurity and those kinds of things. And now, and of course, that invention of capabilities that never existed before took time. It took time to validate the requirement for such a thing, then to budget the money, then to invent things that had never existed before. But what you see now is the private sector has embraced these technologies in terms of connectivity and cybersecurity, and the private sector is able to implement agile development processes. They're able to fund things much faster than a government 2 or 3 year budgeting cycle. So they're able to move much faster than the defense industrial base and the governments can move. As a result, you're seeing the technology trajectories in areas like connectivity and cybersecurity move at the fastest pace that they've ever moved. And in fact, it's accelerating and steepening trajectory almost every day. So what you're seeing is that where in many cases governments led in these technology sectors some 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, you're seeing private sector companies now being able to move much faster, and the technology leadership comes into the private sector. That's areas where companies like Viasat, that is in fact a top 25 defense company, one of the top 25 defense companies in the United States in terms of size and annual revenue. It enables us because we have that defense expertise and 30 years grounded in that. But we're also moving to be a global internet service provider in the commercial market. So we're able to bring the technologies together of this high-speed satellite connectivity coupled with a holistic integrated cybersecurity capability. And we're able to holistically integrate those capabilities together to offer a cybersecurity defense in depth. So that's the technology side of it. Now, Richard, the other thing, though, is I would be remiss not to say that the first and foremost thing that governments and companies must do is establish a security-conscious culture to ensure that the resources are spent with people implementing processes, procedures, and having a consciousness with respect to the protection and defense of their networks, and behaving in responsible ways and following processes that with passwords that have sufficient strength and those kinds of things to make sure that there's a consciousness of security that permeates the entire ecosystem.
Mm. I've always thought, possibly erroneously, that cyber as a domain is unique in that it influences every other domain around it. What are the implications for countries or companies or societies, let's say, that aren't able to defend their digital borders effectively?
Well, I think it's kind of a graduated scale. The societies or cultures or countries that have the richest technology and are on the steepest and fastest technology trajectories and have the economies that can invest, okay, to accelerate these technology trajectories. Clearly, they are the richest target for cybersecurity attacks, because in many ways, it's that technology or those financial resources that are the target of these attacks. Now, lesser countries that don't pose as rich a target don't have the economics to pose as rich of a defense, okay? But in many ways, so the invention and the steadily improving technology trajectory of cyber defense, that burden really falls on nations like the United States and the UK because on the one hand, they have the most at stake, but on the other hand, they have the best resources and the technologies in order to protect that. And an example is take our Viasat satellite network that I referred to before. We have several million subscribers, devices on our network at any point in time, and we move 500 terabytes of metadata across our network every day. We see about 2.4 billion cyber interesting events on a daily basis. That's remarkable, right? I mean, we actually analyze about 100,000 new indicators of compromise each day. We look at 600,000 net flows of traffic data per minute, and we actually harvest 27 terabytes of event data daily from this diverse set of subscribers that use our network that include commercial, residential, enterprise, businesses, government, and defense customers. So when we think of applying big data analytics, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, the fact that we have this large set of data and the fact that the data that our subscriber base is so diverse means we have a very diverse set of use cases on our network. Because we have a diverse set of use cases, we have a very diverse set of cyber threats. And because we have this large amount of data and because we have diversity of data, our machine learning, our artificial intelligence, our data analytics, our behavior analytics are able to learn much faster because we have this rich, diverse set of data. So we're actually able to move faster than many governments can move, only because the governments offer a stovepipe system with only government users and government use cases, and therefore they do not have this rich resource in order to learn faster. Okay, that's why the Department of Homeland Security Enhanced Cybersecurity Services Program, ECS program, is so interested in companies like Viasat and has audited exhaustively our capabilities, processes, techniques, and procedures in order to accredit us as a part of this ECS program. So what we're able to do is we're able to bring classified threat information, as well as Homeland Security threat information, as well as all the other threat information that is available in the private sector. We're able to bring that all to bear and offer a defense in depth, not just a perimeter defense on cyber, but a defense in depth. And because we're a type one information assurance provider, we build type one encryption equipment that moves at breakneck speeds. We offer, hundreds of gigabits per second devices that secure cloud connectivity for cloud providers and those kind of things. We're the only company in the world that does that. But the fact that we have that much data moving across our network is empowering the technology trajectory and accelerating our technology trajectory in ways that other companies can't. That's what the Department of Homeland Security is recognizing in making us a part of this program.
Yeah, indeed. I want to touch on the ETS program in a second, but just to go back to one of your earlier points, you're talking about you're able to adapt and move at speed, sort of counter threats and continue to evolve the capabilities that you need in order to satisfy what your customers want. So that sounds like a very difficult thing to do, because I think one of the things that the cyber domain is relatively unique in terms of it's able, or very small, or very small actors or a very small number of people are able to impart or enact a great deal of damage. This sort of quantitative imbalance means that someone doesn't need an awful lot of resources, but with the right skills and the right set of expertise, they can do an awful lot of damage to very large enterprises. So how does a company the size of Viasat, and how do governments keep evolving to match that threat and the pace of change, I think?
First of all, Richard, you're exactly right. Okay, with a relatively small investment, you can wreak enormous havoc and damage through the cyber domain, right? So we do two things. The first of all, because we are moving toward being a global internet service provider and a global connectivity provider, serving this diverse set of customer subscriber community. Okay. We field this entire ecosystem, satellites, ground infrastructure, teleports, user terminals. We control the entire ecosystem, and we design the ecosystem with security baked in from the very beginning. So the cybersecurity and the security approach is an inherent, integral part of the architecture of our network. Companies that aren't both a communications connectivity provider and a cybersecurity expert cannot do that. They're stuck bolting on some type of security product to their network separately. And obviously, you can see that that does not have the same kind of capability. The second thing then is that because it's holistically designed in and because we use what we call a DevOps model, we are constantly evolving and optimizing our network performance to support the steadily evolving use cases of how people in different apps use our network. The apps are continually evolving. They use the network in different ways. And so we are constantly evolving and optimizing our network to maintain, keep pace with the trajectory of these evolving use cases. We do the same thing with our cybersecurity. We're constantly evolving our cybersecurity capability because it's integrally designed and holistically a part of our network ecosystem. We also continually upgrade that. So I think that on a routine basis, it's not uncommon for us to implement a network optimization cybersecurity improvement across our entire network on, say, every few hours. Okay, so the network is constantly changing. The second arm of our defense is a trusted cyber sensing technology that we actually forward deploy in our customers' network. Okay, and it senses cyber threats, and it has the ability to process and deal with those threats at the edge of our network without having to communicate back to the cybersecurity operations center in order to implement some type of security processing and some type of defense, and then roll that back out to the edge. Our trusted cyber sensor capability, and we're one of only two companies that I know of that has such a capability, but it allows us to deal with threats inside our customer networks without having to communicate through the cloud back to the cybersecurity center in order to take actionable defensive measures.
It's fascinating the way you've described it there. It sounds like effectively a very similar concept to what many militaries are doing, which is distributed operations. They're trying to spread out the capabilities to meet the threat at source as opposed to waiting for the threat to come to them.
That is exactly right, because in a tactical military operation, that unit that can't always be assured that it will have backhaul connectivity to the cloud. So we're able to do detailed, and we also do analyses that others don't do. We provide network traffic flow indicators to help customers detect malicious activity on their network. And this is in addition to the traditional email and domain name indicators that others use. And again, we're able to apply classified threat vectors, homeland security threat vectors, threat vectors from local government, as well as through industry and private sector. So we can bring the confluence of all these different threats together and do behavior analytics such that we can start to become, we can start to anticipate cyber events before they happen, because we can see the behavior analytics and we can see the trend that these cyber threat vectors are on over time.
You've already touched on it, but it was in February this year that Viasat announced that it would begin, I think, to receive cyber threat intelligence through the Department of Homeland Security and the Enhanced Cybersecurity Services Program. So what's the significance of this? What does this change for Viasat's ability to operate in this domain?
It expands and strengthens the lens through which we can detect bad actors. It allows us to anticipate the vectors that might come from sovereign nations that are of a classified nature. And it is a capability that, you know, other commercial companies, other than these Viasat and these other three companies that have been granted this Enhanced Cybersecurity Services Program accreditation. Other than that, no other companies have the breadth of the classified signature threat capability that we have.
Just finally then, I mean, what's Viasat looking to do in the near and long term, as much as you can plan in the cyber domain? But what sort of changes do you see potentially in the digital battle space emerging in the near and medium term? And how is Viasat going to try and meet this challenge, try and stay relevant and current?
Well, we believe we're leading the charge in terms of this kind of a technology trajectory. On the one hand, we're able to operate at speed, at cloud-like speeds. We're the only ones that offer encryptor and information assurance capability that's operating in the hundreds of gigabits per second. And we're in every 18 to 24 months, we're increasing that speed because we're continuing to invest in that capability. This trusted cyber sensor that we can forward deploy inside customer networks that can behave and in a in an actionable way to detect and deal with cyber threats in our customer and subscriber domains. That enables us to increases the speed at which we can deal with the threats, and it helps deal with the threats in a way that does not require a backhaul connection to our cybersecurity sensor. So that's another way that we can operate at pace. In addition to that, we're investing significantly in machine learning and AI, data analytics and behavior analytics, because in many ways, when we first see a cyber threat, it might be a fairly unsophisticated, unpolished threat that attacks a low priority customer, maybe a home residential user somewhere. Okay. And then in a little while later, that threat will come back. And it will be a little more sophisticated, a little more mature, a little more capable. And it'll attack a small business, or and then it moves to a mayor's office. And then maybe it moves to a defense customer. And ultimately, it moves to a very high dollar, high value target. What we're able to do as we watch this progression, because we have this diverse user base with these diverse set of use cases, we're able to see the progression of this cyber threat as it becomes more sophisticated and it becomes more threatening. We're able to anticipate where that threat signature will occur next, what type of target it's really interested in. And we can start to prepare and anticipate and be predictive in anticipating the arrival of that threat, so we can deal with it almost in a kind of an offensive nature where we're ready for it when it finally shows up at that high profile target.
Yeah, I think the notion or the description of forward deploying cyber attack and defense capabilities is the first time that I've heard of that described in that way. It's a fascinating topic. We're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks to Ken Peterman, President of Government Systems at Viasat, for such a really great insight into the sector. Mr. Peterman, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Richard. Pleasure talking with you. It's a fantastic topic.
For 40 years, Shepard has been leading the way in the defense space, and now we're on a mission to revolutionize the industry through connecting decision makers with the best business information and marketing solutions out there. With over 80% of global defense spend, Defense Insight is the leading market analysis tool for anybody in the industry, whilst advertisers can leverage our 1.9 million audience to promote their message with meaning. Shepherd, a full suite of solutions built to give you the decisive edge in defense.
So, welcome to this week's Industry Voice segment. This week, we're brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Bell. I'm sitting down with Carl Kaufman, who is the Vice President of Future Vertical Lift Sales and Strategies at Bell. Carl, first of all, thanks for your time today.
Well, I appreciate you having us, Tony.
So just to set the scene a little bit, we're obviously here to chat about all things to do with vertical lift, in particular what the US Army is doing around its Future Vertical Lift strategy. And I'm going to attempt the acronym. We are in particular talking about the Future Long Range Assault Aircraft, which I guess is being called FLRAA.
Yeah, the Army refers to it as FLRAA. We hopefully are going to move on past future long-range assault aircraft here soon, and we're going to get to a program of record, and then we'll just make it easier. It'll just be the long-range assault aircraft or V-280, either way.
So I guess, yeah, in your case, we're talking about the V-280 Valor, which is a tilt rotor. It takes that kind of the design, I guess, of that, similar to the V-22 that people are familiar with, but applying it to the US Army's future demands and obviously bringing a lot of next generation capabilities. Can we just maybe talk about, I guess, why the program is significant to the US Army in particular? What are you guys kind of hearing from them about why they need this aircraft?
The Army's interested in it primarily because they, as the premier ground maneuver force, as the service that is, you know, the only service that fights, you know, full-scale combat operations over a long period of time in a highly contested environment. That is the Army's mission and the Army's role. And in the future fight, the ranges and the speeds that you're going to be required to operate at, whether it be in the Pacific, whether it be in Eastern Europe, whether it be in the Arctic, there's a significant amount of terrain or, you know, as the Army refers to it, multiple domains you have to operate across. You know, the Army currently with the vertical lift fleet that exists today is challenged by those ranges. So what we are looking to do is develop a system, a long range assault aircraft system that allows the Army to maneuver a ground force over extended ranges, whether that be over water, whether it be over ice, whether it be over land. We want to have a long range maneuver, provide the Army a long range maneuver capability that they are free from the tyranny of terrain, whatever that particular terrain is. And that's where the Army's currently focused. And so that's why we're looking, that's why they're looking for the future long-range assault aircraft.
I guess for the listener, you know, people will be wanting to know about your progress on the V-280 in particular. Can you talk about sort of the test milestones that you've achieved to date? You know, where you guys are on that kind of demonstration testing program?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're very proud of the work that we've done. We're very proud of the work that the long-range assault aircraft, or what we refer to as the V-280 program. So we started this in 2012 in what was referred to as the Joint Multi-Role Technology Demonstration. So we entered an agreement, a technology investment agreement with the Army. We took specifically a look and an assessment across the board at what the Army was trying to develop in terms of this future aircraft. And there were no specific requirements given to us. And that was kind of on purpose, right? And what the Army did that purposely, because what they were trying to do is they were trying to get industry to come to them with what is really in the art of possible in a long-range assault aircraft. So being experienced in tilt rotors and being the tilt rotor company as Bell, that's, you know, what we do. And we've had a lot of proven success with the V-22. You know, we got 600,000 hours of tilt rotor time out there. So when we embarked on this JMRTD effort for the Army to develop a clean sheet designed long-range assault aircraft, we assessed various different technologies. You know, we looked at compound solutions, we looked at coaxial solutions, we looked at traditional rotorcraft solutions, and we looked at tilt rotor solutions. And fundamentally, physically, scientifically, the engineering solution that is the only engineering solution to the ranges and speeds you need to achieve to get to this future fight and the capability that you need in the future is is with a tilt rotor. You have to be able to accomplish, you know, vertical lift and then wing-borne flight, or you're just physically not going to achieve the ranges and speeds you need. So we took our tilt rotor knowledge and our history, and we designed a purpose-built long-range assault aircraft for the Army. And that's what's, you know, resulted in the V-280 today. The Army requirement was go from a clean sheet design aircraft to first flight in roughly 5 years. That was a very challenging timeline. We got busy, we got to work, and we hit our first milestone. We got the aircraft built, and we had first flight on the aircraft in December 2017. So, you know, it wasn't long after that. 3 months later, we had our first Army test pilot in the aircraft. So the Army had a great deal of confidence in the system that we were flying. We had a great deal of confidence in the aircraft that we had designed, built, and were flying. And we rapidly, very rapidly, Tony, we got to 200 knots of level flight, level one agility and quickness, and in low speed agility discussion. There's a lot of discussion about tilt rotors aren't agile at low speeds. Well, we, you know, we busted that myth. We achieved 300 knots. And then, you know, right there in a 2 year period of time, we went through all that to include a autonomy demo. So we flew the aircraft, you know, with safety pilots on board in a low tier of autonomy. And since then, we've worked sling loads. We've done survivability testing. Right now, we're about 210 test flight hours on the aircraft. We've had Army pilots in the aircraft for over 10 test flights. And, you know, we just continue to push, and we continue to, you know, the Army challenges, and we just continue to meet the challenge.
And then I know there's a lot of kind of components at play here, you know, in terms of both the aircraft design, but then also the development of the mission systems and, you know, looking at, I guess, how the aircraft would be used operationally. Just wondering what the next steps are in terms of, you know, taking the program forward. What are you guys kind of focused on?
I think where we have to go next is, you know, there's kind of four key components to an air vehicle or a weapon system program. So you can't think of this as just an air vehicle. The technology demonstrator and the design is certainly an air vehicle, but the Army is looking for a weapon system, not just an air vehicle. So we're interested in providing that weapon system to them. So what we're pushing out and what we're focused on now is to get to beyond the air vehicle. So the other components of that program are the mission equipment package that goes on the aircraft that actually makes it a weapon system, the training and sustainability discussion of how do you increase readiness, how do you increase readiness rates, how do you reduce sustainment cost, how do you train the aircraft without having to go through a major training-based change. There will be some, but we're looking at different ways of doing that. And then also being able to manufacture the aircraft as well using advanced manufacturing technique. So what we're trying to do is the value proposition of that is for us to provide the Army with an air vehicle that has a common open backbone. Think of it as a common open central nervous system to the aircraft. So when we start to integrate those mission equipment, those capabilities in terms of, you know, communications, navigation, survivability gear, all those things, we can, you know, go to best source, you know, best case, you know, optimal solutions, and we can plug those into that backbone kind of free of being vendor locked to any one mission equipment provider. And that's, I think, important to the Army as well. We're digging into all of those things. We know that, you know, it's interesting that we have demonstrated 200 knots on a clean sheet design tilt rotor aircraft, but we're ready to move on from that. The key now is we're working to reduce risk in providing a mission equipment package for the total weapon system. We are reducing risk in our manufacturing techniques, informing those, and we are reducing risk in our sustainment concepts. So the point is to get, you know, you're never going to get to a no risk program when it comes to something like this, but you certainly have to get to a low risk program. And we're on that path right now. And so we're going to hit those other three very hard here in the future.
So, I mean, Carl, as somebody who's been writing about these type of technologies off and on over the last sort of 10, 15 years, it's really exciting to be talking about a design that's not a traditional helicopter design. You know, if you look at the future vertical lift and what the capability is going to entail, Clearly, it's kind of a step change in terms of operations. So, I mean, I guess if we're excited about the opportunities, you guys must be. What are you excited about? And you know, what are you guys sort of focused on as you sort of move this program forward?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. At some point, we're going to require speeds and ranges that evolve past traditional rotorcraft design, right, or traditional helicopter design. You're going to have to come up with a compound solution or a tilt rotor solution or other future solutions that we haven't even thought of yet. So, there's a lot of interest in this across the board. There's a lot of interest here in the United States, certainly, of course, or we wouldn't be on this path that we're on right now. But we've also received a lot of international interest as well. You know, our UK allies, our other allies, coalition partners across the globe are asking questions and engaging with the U.S. Army with letters of intent, informally, with letters of intent and wanting to understand where the requirements development process and this is going and what the potential opportunities are for this type of aircraft in the future. It's not going to be a U.S. only thing here in the future as this continues on. We will require our coalition and allied partners and hope that they have the same capabilities that we have in terms of that joint fight and that coalition fight. And, the conversations has started and there are international interests out there.
To learn more about the latest developments of the Bell V-280 Valor and the generational advances it is bringing to the U.S. Army, you can visit bellflight.com. For now, Carl, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks for having us.
This episode of the Weekly Defense Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Bell. A big thanks to everyone who took the time in being with us today. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed the show, make sure you like and subscribe. Leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. If you want to know more about the market landscape of the defense sector, visit shepherdmedia.com/subscribe and redeem your free trial to our premium news, where you can get international coverage of equipment, innovation, company news, program updates, and more from our team of expert journalists.